From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. For the third day in a row, the Dow Industrials slipped into bear market territory, down 20% from its peak, before recovering to hover just above that threshold. All three major indexes closed slightly higher today. As NPR's Kurt Nickisch reports, many small investors are shrugging their shoulders at this market.
While the Dow Industrial spent much of the day in the bear's grasp, the closest some household investors came to seeing bears was Bubba and Smokey. The two black bear cubs just went on display at the zoo in Stoneham, Massachusetts.
These are the bears I like. I like to see the black bears. Those are the good ones. The Wall Street ones are not. They're not that good.
William Cameron, a local engineer, is very worried about his retirement savings, which have really been taking a hit. But he doesn't want to take a loss and move into something more stable because he could lose a second time if the stock market bounces back.
You know, something breaks somewhere and then that'll back into a bull market or the bear market continues, you know. You just have to wait and see what happens.
Catherine Webb is a little more pessimistic. The substitute teacher from Maine brought her four kids here to see the new bear cubs, and she's resigned to dealing with a bear market, too.
It's just dropping every day. I don't see it improving for a long time.
Still, she's also leaving her investments alone. She's just not putting any more money into them.
Don't add to it. I can spend it on my kids instead.
They're laughing nervously, but Webb and Cameron are actually pretty typical of what financial planners have been seeing lately.
I'm not seeing panic at all.
Barbara Attardo is with Tophius Financial Advisors in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She says she's actually gotten very few calls from clients fretting about whether to liquidate. She thinks people learned from when the tech bubble burst and they're more realistic about ups and downs.
We're down right now, but we're close to the lows that we were in January. It's not like we haven't been here before.
Attardo says people could lose their patience with the market if it starts dropping off more sharply. But for now, she says most average investors aren't seeing bears or bulls. They're just waiting to see. Kurt Nickisch, NPR News.
Beyond the markets, beyond the mortgage crisis, here's another sign of the strained economy. People are having a harder time paying those credit card bills. Delinquencies are creeping upward, and banks are jacking up interest rates, lowering credit limits, and introducing new fees. To find out more about this, we called Robert Manning. He's the director of the Center for Consumer Financial Services at the Rochester Institute of Technology. He's also the author of the book Credit Card Nation.
American consumers are, in many cases now, because they don't have access to credit and the asset value of their homes, the one source of credit that's available to them at higher and higher interest rates is credit cards. On the other hand, what we're seeing also is that foreign investors that are seeking to purchase credit cards are looking at them more and more in terms of credit card debt portfolios as another form of a subprime loan product, and they're shying away increasingly at a period in time when American banks desperately need an infusion of outside capital.
How are the problems in the credit card sector related to the mortgage mess, and could we possibly be looking at a rerun of the subprime mortgage meltdown?
Well, what has concerned me over the last 6 or 7 years is people were qualified for higher lines of credit on their credit cards because they had a house that they owned, and the perception was the bank would encourage people to pay off their credit cards with a home equity loan. With that option over, what we're going to see now is more and more people that are less and less creditworthy and more facing the risk of losing a job during a recession that will have no other recourse when they hit the maximum on their credit cards, but to seek some form of bankruptcy protection. What we've clearly seen is that foreclosure of the home is soon going to follow the default on the credit card. And this is a double whammy that the American banking system is much, much less capable of withstanding today.
What's surprising is banks are raising rates, lowering limits, taking steps to protect themselves from losses, but in some cases, they're raising interest rates on customers who have good credit, people who have no late payments, no blotches on their credit histories. How can they do that?
You know, and that's something that's especially troubling in this period of time, is we have to understand that a major credit card issuer also is assuming huge losses on their subprime and other mortgage and fixed equity investments. That's putting pressure on the credit card divisions to return higher profits. So as a result, what we're seeing is more and more Americans who have completely played by the rules of the game and paid on time finding that their interest rate is jumping 5, 10, 15%. And so many of these decisions now are a product of the information economy. Because it's relatively inexpensive to pull credit reports, and some credit card companies actually monitor what you purchase on your credit card, if the company doesn't like it and they decide that that makes that person more at risk, simply making purchases and paying on time could still trigger an increase in the cost of credit.
So if the credit card companies are monitoring purchases, if someone is using their credit card to pay off a mortgage or to buy essentials like bread or milk or something like that, could that be a trigger?
Oh, absolutely. There's a lot of concern, for example, of somebody who bought new tires and they didn't like the fact that they purchased retread tires. And that triggered somebody in the risk management office of the credit card company to say this person was falling into a period of financial distress, and they repriced and raised the interest rate on that account holder.
Mr. Manning, if we're looking at rough waters ahead in the credit card sector, what can or should consumers do right now to protect themselves?
Well, what's really, really important is that consumers monitor their monthly statements and call and complain at any increase in their interest rates, question any fees that have been incurred, and also it's incredibly important today that people pay their monthly payments earlier than the due date so that they don't fall into a repricing scrutiny of the credit card industry so that they have one late fee that could trigger hundreds of dollars of higher interest rates with their other financial accounts.
Mr. Manning, thanks for talking to us.
Always.
Robert Manning is the author of Credit Card Nation. He's also the director of the Center for Consumer Financial Services. That's a research center at the Rochester Institute of Technology.
Back now with Day to Day. People are not buying cars like they used to. Carmakers released their June sales figures today, and the numbers are expected to be the lowest in 16 years. One big problem, many of these vehicles get poor gas mileage. Car dealers might be moving more vehicles if only they had the right models on their lots. NPR's Celeste Headley reports.
This is a car dealership in Los Angeles. Lining the sidewalk are rows and rows of gleaming pickup trucks that can haul full sheets of drywall. And on this side, you've got SUVs that can carry 5 to 7 of your closest friends. These vehicles get somewhere between 10 and 15 miles per gallon. And just a few months ago, they were hot sellers. But then, suddenly, in May, gas hit $3.75 a gallon.
I've been in the business now for almost 30 years, and I have never seen an abrupt about-face by consumers in terms of what it is they want to buy like we've seen over the last 2 months.
John Wolkonowicz is a senior automotive analyst at Global Insight. He says now nearly everyone wants a car that gets at least 30 miles per gallon.
Everybody got caught very surprised, the whole industry.
It costs about $50 now to fill the tank of even a smaller car. Tom Wilkinson with General Motors says his company knew Americans would eventually want more fuel-efficient vehicles, but they didn't know they'd want them now. Full-size truck sales seem to be doing well.
They had been declining very gradually over the last couple of years, and it was a manageable decline, and it was still a very profitable market and a very large market.
But then in May, gas began to inch toward $4 a gallon, and the trucks stopped moving.
Cars like Corollas and Chevy Cobalts and Ford Focuses and Honda Civics were selling at twice the rate they were manufacturing them.
John Wolkonowicz says auto sales were low last month, partly because dealerships didn't have enough smaller cars in stock. And Wilkinson at GM says the only people buying full-size trucks and SUVs now are the ones that really need them.
The guy like me who goes to Home Depot twice a month and brings home a bag of mulch probably won't buy a full-size truck for personal use.
And Stuart Shore of Chrysler says the big question is, will truck sales rebound once the price of gas falls or at least stabilizes?
Is this a cyclical change that we often see in the auto industry, and is it related to the current slowdown in housing starts, which is very much linked to pickup truck sales, or is it something more permanent?
Judging by their recent moves, it seems clear that many automakers think the change is permanent. Trucks still account for more than half of GM's annual sales right now, but the company recently transferred engineers from large truck divisions to work on smaller cars. And CEO Rick Wagoner says he'll close 4 factories that build large pickups and SUVs. That probably won't translate into lost jobs, but it will mean a lot of transfers and conversions. That's expensive. And analyst Ron Harber says it's not as easy to turn a profit on a Ford Focus as it is on a Ford F-150.
Because remember, they've got to sell 10 of those to make the profit they do on some large SUV.
John Wolkonowicz says this change in consumer demand couldn't come at a worse time for the domestic automakers who are still implementing turnaround plans.
We're kind of navigating uncharted waters right now. The auto companies and suppliers are in a very difficult time, and I think you could argue they're in a fight for their lives.
Most agree that full-size trucks and SUVs will start to sell again as soon as the home construction industry rebounds and contractors need new vehicles. But even automakers say the days of seeing one person commuting to work in a 7-passenger vehicle are probably numbered. Celeste Headlee, NPR News, Los Angeles.
This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Cohen.
I'm Madeline Brand. We just talked about the Midwest flooding. Later in the program, we'll meet someone who's riding out the fires in California. Earlier this year, there were even worse disasters in China and Myanmar, where tens of thousands of people died. Many more were left with nothing. All these disasters have inspired Americans to open their wallets, but figuring out which charity to give to and how much to give can be confusing.
Here with her advice is Day to Day's personal finance expert, Michelle Singletary. So, Michelle, how much should people put away in their budget for charitable giving?
Well, you know, that's such a tough question because it's a personal decision. I'll tell you what people do. According to one nonprofit organization, JustGive.org, the average American gives about 3.1% of their income to charity. That's before taxes. Now, if you believe in tithing, which means you give 10% of your income, of course, that's what you give. And I put giving at the top of my budget because oftentimes if you wait till you pay everything else, there's nothing left to give away.
So how do you go about choosing the right organization to give to once you've decided to give?
You need to do some research just like you do with anything else. If you were going to buy a car, you would do some research. If you're going to invest in a financial product, you do some research. It's the same thing with charity.
Of course, we do this because we like to be philanthropic, but there are also some financial advantages to giving. What are the tax deductibles that people should be keeping in mind?
Depending on how you do your taxes and if you do qualify for a deduction, you can take a tax deduction for your charitable giving. Check with the organization and see if your deduction is tax deductible. And now there's new requirements. You just can't say, I gave $10,000 to my church. You have to show receipts. If you want to sell your car, you have to know how much it's worth. You can't just say it's worth $10,000 or $20,000 when in fact it's worth, you know, $200. And ask the charity. For example, you know, some people wonder about political donations. You have to ask, in fact, are they a nonprofit? Are they a charitable organization? And therefore, are my contributions tax deductible? And you can go to the IRS website to find out a lot of this information. If you're unsure about the charity, you can go to the Better Business Bureau, which has a whole website set up for you to check on charities.
And you can also, can't you, find out a little bit more about how charities use their money? What kind of things do you want to keep in mind there?
You want to see how much of your money is going towards the cause and how much is going to administrative cost. One thing I don't do, this is my personal rule, is that if I get a call from an organization soliciting donations for a charity, I ask them how much is going towards the actual charity and how much they're getting. Because a lot of times those calls you get, a lot of the money is going to the person who's calling you, you know, a third party company. So I don't give my money to a third party company. I give my money directly to the charity because they get to use more of my money. And the FBI, please go to their website. They've got a lot of tips. And some of those tips include, you know what, don't respond to unsolicited spam email. I mean, we know the charities that are in need, particularly after a disaster like in China. You want to contact them directly. And don't provide personal financial information.
Day to Day's personal finance contributor is Michelle Singletary. Thanks so much, Michelle.
You're welcome.